of Power, a six-part radio series about mind-altering drugs in nature and culture. Written and presented by Nick Rankin. Plants of Power. Program 3, Industrial Power.
All of the plants that we discuss as being narcotic have all had sacred context. Now all of the context has been lost, and this is what we need to reestablish and understand.
Emeritus Professor of Botany, William M. Bowden, author of the classic work, Narcotic Plants. One of the oldest of these is the opium poppy, Papaver somniferum. It's been cultivated for thousands of years for food and as a painkiller. Opium was also deeply bound in with the religion of the ancient Greeks.
I believe the historical traditional use of opium was that of associating it with the gods, because we know that it was consecrated to Nyx, the god of night, to Morpheus, the god of sleep and dreams, and to Thanatos, the god of death. So it was known in a sacred context. And one of the dilemmas of our own society is that we make categories that didn't then exist. For example, among the North American Indian, food and medicine were one word, and the concept was one. And even religion becomes involved with these, and there was a broader context for understanding these plants.
And how does the drug come out of the poppy?
For a long time, opium would be known only through the crude opium, which is achieved by growing the plant until it blossoms, and then after the blossoms fall, depending on the nature of the cultigen, within 3 to 12 days, you may gather a latex by slicing the green capsule. It forms a seed capsule that is filled with seed, and if you don't cut it deeply, you can still harvest the seed from it. And so this white milk oozes out. A few days later, this can be scraped from the capsule as a gum. The gum made into balls, and these crude balls of opium, ranging in size, of course, probably from initially maybe the size of a marble to ultimately the size of baseballs. These were shipped around the world, and they weren't kept in any one area for long, because we know that it was a very short time before the plant was grown in areas like India, Turkey, and pretty soon Burma, Assam. Now one of the great centers of cultivation is Colombia. We worry about the problems with coca in Colombia, but there also are enormous crops of the opium poppy.
For 125 years, opium was one of the most profitable export crops the British Empire had in India. In 1850, opium alone earned 20% of the subcontinent's revenue. Every chest of prime opium from the Ganges Plain contained 40 cannonballs of narcosis weighing a kilo and a half each. Thousands of these 60-kilo chests were exported on fast sailing ships to China to make addicts of the Chinese pipe dreamers and to spearhead other trade and other missions.
The Chinese really wanted more valuable things than this, what they called black foreign mud. This was their name for opium in Chinese. It translates as black foreign mud. And yet it was forced upon them. The Portuguese forced it upon them initially, and then it continued until finally they had to fight in around 1840 of the first opium war, and 15 years later the second opium war, to finally rid the country of this habit that had been pushed upon them. The crude opium contains a lot of other toxins. This is the dilemma of the use of crude opium, and also the problem with those who smoke it. The rich classes would smoke pure opium, raw opium, and those who couldn't afford to do that would use the draw, so that which was left over in the pipe. And that was left with thebaine, papaverine, narcotine, and other strychnine-like alkaloids that have a very profound effect on the system and can lead to death in a very short time. And so we had classes of people according to their ability to pay for these various kinds of opium.
And pay the Chinese people did. That's how Britain's last colony, Hong Kong, first got on its feet, with the drug-running business done by the likes of William Jardine and James Matheson, men who made their shameful fortunes and then shamelessly retired to England to become members of Parliament. Benjamin Disraeli recognized the type in 1845. "Oh, a dreadful man," he wrote in his novel Sybil. "A Scotchman, richer than Croesus, one Mr. Druggy, fresh from Canton, with a million in opium in each pocket, denouncing corruption and bellowing free trade." Opium smoking was the servitude of Asians. Progressive Europe, with its industrial and scientific revolutions, could do far better, according to Professor Roy Porter of the Wellcome Institute for the History of Medicine in London.
From the beginning of the 19th century, chemists begin to subject raw natural opium to chemical analysis in the laboratory. And that takes place particularly in France and in Germany. And there's a French pharmacist called Seguin, and then a German pharmacist called Sertuna. And these are the key figures here. Seguin is the man who isolates morphine, as we call it nowadays, from opium. You take raw opium, sort of put it in the test tube, boil it up, add alkaline substances in order to remove impurities, and you end up with a nice, clean, clear, crystalline substance. Seguin didn't really understand what he'd got, but the German pharmacist Sertuna did. He knew that it was alkaline, he knew it was special, and it was from then that morphine regularly became extracted from raw opium.
Now, there's another development in science that's very important, linked to morphine and other drugs, and that's the invention of the hypodermic syringe. What does this represent in science, and how did it come about?
Always the problem with drugs, whether they are medical drugs or illegal narcotics, is how do you get it into the body? How do you get it into the system? And it wasn't really until the 1830s that the idea of injecting drug substances into the bloodstream by the use of a syringe became really tested. Now, syringes were old, but the new idea of a hypodermic syringe, using a syringe with a hollow needle to inject under the skin and directly into a vein, that really was developed in the 1850s. There was a great big dispute amongst the doctors then as to who it was who had really invented the hypodermic syringe. But on the whole, we nowadays in this country think that it was a Scotsman, Alexander Wood, who was the first person who really popularized that. And once you got the syringe, then it became possible to inject morphine directly. The effect was much more rapid and much more powerful. It's one of the terrible ironies of history that the first person to die of an overdose of drugs that were injected hypodermically was indeed Alexander Wood's wife. And this is symbolic of something that was happening in the 19th century, which is that doctors were very, very keen on the effects of morphine because it was a wonderful painkiller, there's no doubt about that. There was a great deal of dispute and doubt and uncertainty about how far these drugs really were addictive or not. And one of the theories in favour of the injection of drugs beneath the skin, directly into the bloodstream, was the belief that that method would not prove addictive. It was only by eating or swallowing drugs that addiction would follow. So there was a hope that you'd actually avoid addiction by hypodermic injection. That, of course, is absolute bunkum, but that's the medicine learns by its mistakes. And what you get from about the 1860s onwards is an enormous epidemic of what was called morphinism. That's to say, addiction to morphine that was originally doctor-prescribed. Doctors actually encouraged their patients to carry their own hypodermic syringes and to inject themselves. It was thought then to be fairly safe. It proved a complete disaster.
There were more addicted women in the latter half of the 19th century than any other class. We usually think, oh, it must be a lower class person or a black person or some other person. No, it was white, middle class to upper middle class women who were being addicted by physicians. And the reason for this was if they had a migraine headache, which was common, they were given opiates. And if they had tight corsets that cut off their circulation, they had poor digestion, they were given opiates. Just any disease, it was the cure-all for a while. And then morphine addiction became so common that the synthetic heroin was produced, and heroin was thought of as a cure for morphine.
Heroin is a sort of derivative from morphine. You make heroin by boiling up basic morphine with another substance called acetic anhydride, and then you get this hyper-concentrated form of opium in the form of heroin. It was first made in London in St Mary's Hospital in the 1870s, but then it was manufactured by the German Bayer pharmaceutical company from the late 1890s. It was on the open market. You could buy it in lozenges and pastilles, as well as in liquid form, and it was recommended as a cough remedy, as a remedy for tuberculosis and things like that, and as a great painkiller. And it proved infinitely more addictive than morphine. So what was seen as a cure of morphinism turned out to worsen it.
Why is it called heroin?
The people who developed heroin in the 1890s in Germany saw it as the most powerful reliever of pain ever. It was a heroic remedy, heroisch, the German word, and so it got called heroin as a sort of brand name.
Andrew Weil, Dr. Andrew Weil, you're the author of From Chocolate to Morphine, Everything You Need to Know About Mind-Altering Drugs. It's true, isn't it, to say that when industrialized countries come across mind-altering plants, they extract and increase the power, the potency and the power of these plants by not treating them as natural plants anymore.
Yes, or even when they don't do that, they treat the plants in ways that maximizes abuse potential. And I think another interesting example to look at is tobacco. Now, here is a plant that is the chief sacred plant of many Indians in the Americas. When the Spanish came to the Americas, they found Indians smoking tobacco. They'd never seen anyone smoke before. You know, smoking was unknown in the old world before 1492. But if you look at the ways Indians were using tobacco then, most of them were using it as a ritual drug. The forms of tobacco in use were very harsh, so you couldn't inhale them deeply and often to form the pattern of addiction that we see in our cultures today. There are Indians in the Amazon that build giant cigars of very strong tobacco, and on feast occasions, they take turns puffing on these things and get very high from it. But they don't do it very often. This is an occasional use. I have an Indian friend, a shaman of a tribe in California. One of his titles is a smoke doctor, and he uses a lot of tobacco smoke in his healing ceremonies. He was taught by his elders that tobacco smoke is to be taken into the mouth, blown out the nose and mouth, that the smoke carries prayers to the spirit realm. You're not supposed to inhale it. He said that was a white man's mistake and that we're now paying for our error. In America, just after the Civil War, the tobacco industry developed a new form of tobacco, a new genetic strain, and a new method of processing it that produced for the first time a smoking product, the modern cigarette, which could be inhaled deeply and often. And this establishes the brain pattern of dependence on nicotine, which is the root of tobacco addiction today, and the source of immense grief, as you know. Here again is an example of, I think, where we've gone wrong with the drug plant, that rather than seeing it as something to be used ritually, sacredly, perhaps occasionally, we have maximized its harmful element in the way that we've prepared it and distributed it for use. So here's a case where we haven't taken the drug out of the plant, but nonetheless, we have maximized the destructive potential of that plant.
Tobacco was considered the great aphrodisiac. Once a plant was spread as an aphrodisiac, its reputation became very, very great. And we'll find with many of these sacred plants that was indeed the case, without any validity. For example, even with chocolate, it was an aphrodisiac, and that's why it was spread so rapidly. Tobacco traveled because of its reputation, but the tobacco seed is as small as can be imagined. It's like dust. You could literally hold a million tobacco seeds in your hand, in one hand. So it was easy to pack up the seed, and in any climate that was reasonably temperate for a brief time of the year, you could grow at least one of the varieties of tobacco. the tobacco was carried about as seed and was introduced to diverse parts of the world to be used in every imaginable form, from snorting, snuffing, cigars, in every form. And again, I would return to that idea that we're dealing with a seeming aphrodisiac, which is really not so. But the idea that it does break neural synapses and it does give one a relief from the boredom of the day or whatever ills might be plaguing one for a time leads to ultimately addiction. And we, it seems like only recently we've been treating this as an addictive drug, whereas I remember even in my own book I had treated it as an enigmatic, I called it tobacco the enigmatic narcotic, and at that time no one was treating tobacco as a narcotic.
Tobacco smoking began as shamanistic ritual in South America, became democratized through the shared peace pipe of North America, and has now been sold to everyone around the world by big business. Andrew Weil insists that the active drug nicotine in the tobacco of cigarettes is highly addictive.
When you inhale tobacco smoke, this is a very direct way of introducing nicotine to the brain. It's one step down from drilling a hole in your skull, putting a needle in and giving little pulses of nicotine to deep brain centers. An inhalation of vapor is a very, very direct way of taking a drug into the brain. And there are centers in the brain that respond very powerfully to nicotine. And once this cycle is established, the brain craves nicotine about every 20 minutes. And I think it's fascinating that although this is right in front of our eyes and something that everybody could see, when I was in medical school in the late 60s, I was taught that cigarette smoking was not an addiction, that it was a psychological habit, and therefore it wasn't important. It wasn't anything we had to study. You know, even though, as I said, right in front of our eyes, we can see that people who use the substance have to use it every 20 minutes. You know, there's nothing else like that. And it took the medical profession a remarkably long time to begin looking for what was the basis of this behavior.
What happens is, though, that when you get an industry that can influence politics and
Absolutely.
Creates jobs
Absolutely.
And all the rest of it, you have vested interests.
Enormous vested interests. Actually, in America, I know the history of this quite well, tobacco was the first cash crop that the colonies had. So it was the first thing that they could trade for money with England and with Europe. So tobacco has always held a very special place in the economy of America and of England as well. When I hear presidents of the United States, as a recent one did, calling for a drug-free America, I have to laugh. You know, no one wants to see a drug-free America. We'd like to see an America free of the drugs we don't like and don't make money off of. But as for the ones we do, I mean, that's business as usual.
Philip Morris, the world's biggest tobacco company, exported 662.2 billion cigarettes last year. That's over 6 packets for every man, woman, and child on the planet. The 80% increase in foreign sales over the last few years is mainly to Asia. William M. Bowden can see what's happening.
We spoke of the use of opium and the opium wars. We're doing to Asia precisely what Great Britain was doing to China in the 19th century. We're pushing all of our tobacco into Asia, and we're addicting as many people as we can, trying to create Asian markets and literally forcing it upon these people. We won't give them food, but we will give them tobacco. There are so many goods that they need in terms of food and medicine, and yet we give them tobacco because we need their addiction so they will be able to constantly purchase tobacco from us.
We've touched on opium and tobacco, so how about cocaine to make a trinity? Yet again, we seem to have taken the wrong path, according to Andrew Weil.
The whole history of coke and cocaine, I think, is probably the best example we could find of what you should not do with one of these drug plants. You know, we came to South America, where the Spanish did, saw Indians chewing coca. Their immediate reaction was that this was something satanic and horrible, and they tried to stamp it out. They quickly found that they couldn't do that, in particular that if they wanted Indians to work for them in their mines, they had to give them coca. So then they began to tax coca and take control over it. But they never tried it themselves. Again, they saw this as a dirty habit of people who they considered subhuman, and they didn't try it themselves, even though Indians told them that this was a superior remedy and very good for the constitution and helpful with altitude sickness and so forth. It took remarkably long time before European scientists took any interest in coca. Really not until the middle 1800s. And then very shortly after they did, a German scientist isolated cocaine from the leaf. And cocaine was released to the world as the active essence of coca that embodied all of its principles. So research on coca leaf stopped, and everyone began experimenting with cocaine. And as you know, in the 1880s, cocaine was widely promoted by the medical profession as a cure-all for everything. And widespread addiction followed in the wake of that. So this was entirely medically created. And then when there was a great public outcry about the harmfulness of cocaine, the medical profession took the position, as it has in many instances since then, that it was not their fault, that the problem was that the drug itself was bad, with no redeeming qualities, and that the ultimate source of the badness was the plant itself. So cocaine was banned, instantly creating a black market for it. And now we're at the other end of this, where our society is now relentlessly involved with trying to eradicate coca in South America and prevent Indians from using it, because we blew it.
So, to the rescue, once again, the greatest ethnobotanist of this century, Richard Evans Schultes of Harvard University, who's dedicated his whole life to understanding how American Indians use plants. Richard Evans Schultes sent his best student, the late Timothy Plowman, to South America to study the plant Erythroxylon coca. In his much-praised book, One River, the anthropologist Wade Davis has written about both men.
Tim Plowman was Schultes' protege. I once asked Mrs. Schultes whether Tim had been as close as a son to the great professor, and she shook her head and said, no, closer than a son. Tim was the world's expert on coca. In the early 1970s, Schultes sort of managed to do the impossible, secure from the U.S. government $250,000 to study this plant known as the divine leaf of immortality, and of course a notorious source of cocaine. And even though the cartel was emerging, and even though the efforts to eradicate the fields had been underway for over 50 years at that point, astonishing little was known about coca. Nobody knew how many species yielded the alkaloid. Nobody knew anything about the pharmacology of coca chewing. Nobody had even done a nutritional study of the plant, even though it had not only been maligned by physicians, but it was something that was consumed every day by literally millions of South American Indians. And so on a journey made possible by Schultes, inspired by him and certainly infused at all times with his spirit, Timothy and I traveled the length and breadth of South America, studying the ethnobotany and the taxonomy of this most wondrous plant of the Inca. And what we found was really quite amazing. I mean, at one level, coca symbolized the very fabric of Andean life. There was no gesture that could be begun without some kind of use of the coca leaf. When you met people on the trail, you didn't shake hands, you traded leaves. Distances were measured in the Andes, not in miles or kilometers, but in coca chews. There were societies where the entire societal ideal was to abstain from sex, eating, and sleeping, and do nothing but chew the sacred leaves and chant to the ancestors. There were coca diviners who read the future and the venation of the leaves, a skill that could only be possessed by someone who had successfully survived a lightning strike. And the Inca themselves, unable to cultivate the plant at the elevation of the imperial capital of Cusco, had actually replicated it in gold and silver leaf in fields that colored the landscape. And when we did the first nutritional study of the plant, what Tim found was rather astonishing. It turned out that coca, yes, it had a small amount of cocaine in it, 0.5% to 1% dry weight, roughly analogous to the amount of caffeine in a coffee bean. Amount of cocaine absorbed in a very mild and natural form through the mouth in a slow fashion that left it completely benign, a mild stimulant in a harsh environment. But what Tim also found in the plant, much to the regret, I think, of our backers of the U.S. government, was it turned out that this plant was just chock full of vitamins. Not only was it full of vitamins, it had more calcium in it than any plant that had ever been studied by the USDA, which made it perfect for the diet of the Andes that traditionally lacked the milk product, particularly for women that were nursing. It also turned out to have enzymes in it which enhanced the body's ability to digest carbohydrate at high elevation, which made it perfect, of course, for the traditional potato crop diet of the Andes. So in one single gesture of research, if you will, Tim showed that this plant was a benign stimulant that in 4,000 years of being used by Indian peoples and all the pre-Columbian civilizations of South America, in the Andes rather, had never shown any evidence of toxicity, let alone addiction, and that it was a fundamental part of the nutritional regime of the people themselves. So this plant that had been so maligned was revealed to be what it was, the true divine leaf of immortality. And this revelation, in some sense, put into stark contrast the draconian efforts financed and organized and promoted by the U.S. government that certainly persist even more so today than they did 20 years ago to poison the coca fields with all the various herbicides and insecticides that today pollute the headwater rivers of the Mother Amazon herself.
By the way, I think it's also worth noting that our drug policies, which in the U.S. Began about 1914 with the passage of the Harrison Narcotics Act, which mentioned cocaine, have directly led to the disappearance of coca and coca products from our world, while encouraging an ever-expanding black market in cocaine, which is easy to smuggle. I mean, nobody's going to smuggle coca leaves, which are bulky and have very low amounts of the drug, and everybody's going to try to smuggle this concentrated white powder, which is worth so much money. So I think our drug laws and drug policies have directly contributed to the wave of abuse that we have by driving out of circulation the natural form of the drug, which has a much, much lower abuse potential, and encouraging commerce in this isolated chemical, which has a very high potential for abuse.
And therefore encouraging gangsterdom, criminality,
and
violence.
All of it. As I said, it's a real object lesson in what not to do when you encounter a drug plant in the world. I think the history of coca and cocaine provides the best illustration of all the things that we've done wrong, culminating now, as I said, with our attempts to prevent natives in South America from using their sacred leaf.
Plants of Power, a six-part radio series about mind-altering drugs in nature and culture. Written and presented by Nick Rankin. Plants of Power, Program 4, Alcohol Power.
The discovery of most of our major psychoactive drugs came from early man watching animals.
Dr. Ron Siegel, who's been researching animal behavior with drugs for 25 years.
For example, the legendary discovery of coffee was by an Abyssinian shepherd who noticed that his goats became abnormally frisky after eating the bright red fruit of this plant. And when he tried the fruit, he found that indeed he became a little frisky too. And that's how coffee was discovered. Coca, from which cocaine comes, was discovered the same way, according to folklore, by native Andean Indians watching their llamas and their alpacas eating these leaves. And they copied the behavior. Almost all of our drug plants seem to have been modeled after animal use. For example, elephants really don't have a lot of drug plants in their environment, but they have very keen olfactory receptors. And they can pick up the scent of fermented fruit from long distances up to 75 miles away with a good wind. And they will migrate out of their way in Africa to get to this fruit. Now, this fruit is only about 8% alcohol. It's enough to get them a little tipsy and a little shaky on their feet, but that's about it. When they accidentally wander into moonshine distilleries, they might drink stronger alcohol, and then they will engage in some rather nasty drunken behavior, where they become extremely aggressive, they smash village huts, they stampede, and they have even been known to trample people.
I have seen large vats of brew, fermenting millet, in fact, emptied by elephants at night. They've come to a village and they've emptied the vat. That I have seen.
The zoologist and artist Jonathan Kingdon was born and bred in East Africa.
Any animal that associates a particular food or a drink with pleasure in any shape or form is quite easily habituated to that. I know that a monkey that I was brought up with as a small child started to bite me and my friends and was given to somebody, and later we heard that it became a total drunkard. This was a baboon, because he was a heavy drinker himself, took it off to the pubs and used to delight in filling it up with Tusker beer, and it used to fall off its stool to the great amusement of people. Very cruel and unnecessary and unpleasant, but what it does demonstrate is that primates particularly are susceptible to alcohol, and primates would be probably of all animals, perhaps with the exception of pigs, the most likely to come across what is effectively alcoholic beverages in the form of great quantities of fermenting fruit.
Dr. Andrew Weil, you've written a lot about drugs, and particularly in two of your books, From Chocolate to Morphine, Everything You Need to Know About Mind-Altering Drugs, and your famous book from 1972, The Natural Mind, A New Way of Looking at Drugs and Higher Consciousness. I want to talk about values now, because drug use and the cultures that use drugs and what we call a drug and what we think of as food or something perfectly normal is deeply tied up with the values of a culture and a society.
Now, even how we define a drug. You know, is sugar a drug, for example? There are people that say they get high from sugar, and there are people who say they get addicted to sugar. Is salt a drug? You know, is alcohol a drug? The body can metabolize it like a food. It's clearly a poison in high doses. It's a favored social intoxicant. But I still very commonly hear the phrase drugs and alcohol as if alcohol is something different. You know, so we have a certain set of associations to the word drug. Drugs are good if they're being used by doctors for the purpose of healing. They're bad if they're being used by people to get high for fun, at least if it's not one of the drugs that we approve of. So there's a great deal of value in all of this.
Human energy, power and serenity, dream time, real life, vision of eternity.
And the value is commercial, too. Some scholars think that the plants of power are a staple of civilization, basic to the trade that has tied the global village together.
These substances are not just part of a cultural history of humankind, they are absolutely integral to the economic history at every stage. Perhaps the precious metals are the ones that are the first stage of international trade, but amongst the next level are these desirable organic consumables.
Andrew Sherratt, you teach archaeology, you're in charge of the prehistoric collection at the Ashmolean Museum in Oxford, and you're also the co-editor of the volume of essays Consuming Habits, Drugs in History and Anthropology. And you've written the first essay in this, which is called Alcohol and Its Alternatives. And one of your ideas in that is that if you look back in history, there are broadly two kinds of cultures. There are smoking and chewing cultures, and then there are drinking cultures. Can you explain that?
There's a lovely phrase in John Locke's treatise on civil government, which says, in the beginning, all the world was America. And what he meant by that was that the picture presented by the newly discovered Indians of North America was a model for what the original condition of humanity might have been. And in a sense, I think this is a very valuable perception, because when we look at North America, one of the interesting things is the importance of tobacco, the pipe of peace, the ritual use of tobacco, not simply a hedonistic use, not simply being used for relaxation, but a very, very powerful medicine and also a very powerful social tool. Now, the evidence that we have from prehistoric Europe clearly doesn't include things like tobacco pipes. But there are, in fact, quite a large number of rather enigmatic objects with open sides, things that have traditionally been called incense cups or braziers. And putting these two things together, it seems to me entirely likely that what we're looking at are a whole set of rituals based essentially on the smoking and the inhalation of fumes from, well, we have a number of plants to choose from, but let's just leave it at that level for the moment and say that there is evidence that these little braziers were culturally important.
Well, we do have evidence from Herodotus talking about the Scythians, where he saw them throwing hemp seeds, cannabis seeds, inside a tent, a triangular tent, and they inhaled the fumes and howled like animals.
That's absolutely right, and that's one of the best links back to this prehistoric situation. And what really clinched it for me was going into the Hermitage in St. Petersburg and seeing the objects from the frozen tombs of Pazuruk in the Altai Mountains on the other end of Siberia, and they are absolutely exactly the set of equipment described by Herodotus. There is the framework of a little tent, there are the bronze braziers, still with the coals inside them, still with the charcoal, and indeed still with the hemp seeds. It is absolutely astonishing that something that was interred in the ground in 500 BC, or thereabouts, frozen in the permafrost, because that's how these things have been so miraculously preserved, should give such a direct reflection of what Herodotus talks about in Book 4 of his histories. So we can trace back a millennial-old tradition, because these little smoking cups, these little braziers, are found in tombs, the pottery ones are found in tombs, going right back to 3000 BC or before. And that, I think, was the general pattern before drinking, before the consumption of alcohol, took precisely the prime cultural role that it now has.
The first book of the Bible is full of stories about the plants of power. The first woman, Eve, gives the first man, Adam, a mind-altering fruit, and together they fall from the hunter-gatherer's paradise into the hard work of early farming. Their two sons divide the labor. One becomes a herder, the other a tiller of the soil. The one who grows the vegetables is jealous of his more nomadic, freer brother. This earth digger, whose name is Cain, kills his animal-driving brother, Abel. Then the first murderer goes east, and in the land of Nod, he founds the first city. This could be the myth of the first cities of Mesopotamia, the land between two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, in the country that is now called Iraq. It's important that Cain is a digger and a planter and a winemaker in this story, because, as I put it to Andrew Sherratt, there is no civilization without cultivation first, and urban culture depends on agriculture.
What happened in Western Asia from 6000 BC or so onwards was the development of a second generation of products, things like the tree crops, things like these sugar and oil-rich olives as the oil crop, vines, and particularly dates as the sugar-rich fruits, which, of course, were very easily fermented. And my own view is that it was with the date that fermentation first became a process that humans were familiar with and then tried to transfer to other sorts of products.
Now, civilization, the living in cities, spreads out of Mesopotamia, around the Mediterranean, you think of Greece, all these things are associated with wine. But in your essay, you point out that there are drier peoples who come out of the desert and the semi-desert and out of the steppes. Can you tell me how, say, the rise of Islam, which is not a wine-based culture, came about?
Well, let's go back to my original formulation that, as it were, the aboriginal state of humanity in Europe was a set of smoking cultures or chewing cultures using the psychoactive plants from their native flora. Remember that the opium poppy is part of the West Mediterranean flora. On the east, cannabis is a steppe plant and was used, as we were saying, back into the 4th millennium and almost certainly before. So these things have age-old usages. But I think what one can see in Europe is the tremendous prestige associated with drinking and the elaborate gold and silver drinking vessels that were made for the elites of the period. So the development of alcohol had this tremendous effect on the areas which were capable of producing the sugars that were fermentable into this marvellous drink. But in areas, dry areas like the steppes or the deserts, which were not areas where grapes could be grown or where sugar-rich fermentable crops could be grown, then the habits of smoking, the habits of taking narcotic substances by inhalation, continued to be the basis of social life. And indeed, the difference became, as it were, a badge of identity, that the people who came out of the desert increasingly during the 1st millennium BC and in the 1st millennium AD to dominate the town dwellers, hard-riding, camel-riding nomads who despised things like the use of the wheel, who despised the drinking of wine, who despised the use of silver vessels and all the luxury and ostentation and degenerate city life that went with it. In a sense, they created their own identity in opposition to this by emphasizing what was different about their own way of life. And so we have this proscription of wine drinking, which in a sense is an attack on all that city-dwelling Mediterranean civilization stands for. It sums it up so perfectly as the quintessential product and consumable of its everyday life and indeed of its religions. And so to proscribe this, to forbid it, was a very powerful ideological statement. But of course what wasn't forbidden was the consumption of the kinds of stimulants or narcotics that were traditionally in use in the desert. And further south, the use of coffee on a very small scale, the berries were originally chewed, was typical of the way in which things like kola nuts in West Africa, things like gut in East Africa and Somalia were used as stimulants. So these came to have much greater cultural prominence. These and things like cannabis.
As I've said, I think that almost every culture uses intoxicants. We tend to see the intoxicants we use as being good or okay, and the intoxicants that other people use as being bad. But there's no agreement from culture to culture as to which are the good substances and which are the bad substances. You know, if you're in the mainstream, in our cultures, alcohol is our chiefly accepted substance, mind-altering substance. But if you're a Muslim, that's the big bad drug. You know, and all the things that are said that we say that marijuana does to people, for example, they say alcohol does to people. And sometimes within countries, you find different subpopulations who are at war with each other, and their different choices in intoxicants become symbols of the differences. For example, in Peru, Peru is a country with two nations that have always been at war since the Spanish conquest. There's a Spanish-speaking mestizo population with its capital at sea level at Lima that uses alcohol as its preferred mind-altering substance, and an Indian Quechua-speaking nation with its capital at high altitude in Cusco that uses coca leaf as its chief substance. I was in Ethiopia some years ago, and there you have a Christian alcohol-drinking majority and a Muslim minority that chews a leaf called khat, which is the closest thing that nature produces to amphetamines. And within these countries, there are incredible tensions. And the choice of intoxicant becomes symbolic of a whole subculture.
Coffee Cantata, written by J.S. Bach in 1733. I must have coffee, pour me coffee. In the 17th and 18th centuries, tea and coffee became the new and fashionable stimulants of the cities of Europe. Both hot drinks, brewed from leaves and berries respectively, contain caffeine, which excites and alerts the cerebral cortex. But this became a socially acceptable addiction.
To a certain extent, there was a replay of this tension between alcohol and non-alcohol, in the sense that alcohol was very much associated with a landowning aristocracy, and therefore a rising middle class in the same way, wanting to differentiate itself, wanting to create its own identity, its own sense of respectability, naturally promoted tea and coffee and these stimulating substances that kept you awake rather than alcohol that tends, at least with me, to send one to sleep. This is what the middle classes did. The cup that cheers but not inebriates, as Cooper so wonderfully put it. And so you get a sort of replay of this cultural divide between Christianity and Islam, but now on social grounds, between the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie, expressed in the temperance movement.
The temperance movement, which urged people to moderate their alcohol drinking or to abstain altogether, reached its peak in the United States of America. A country which began as a Puritan experiment, but whose history has always been awash with alcohol. In the colony, in the Republic, everybody drank. You could even see the U.S.'s expansion westward as a tide of alcohol once again eradicating the smoking cultures of the plains dwellers, as the wine of civilization had overcome the barbarians of old Europe. Drink ravaged American Indian cultures, and yet booze seemed to be spiritual. A kind of shortcut for vision-seeking warriors. As William James, the father of American psychology, observed in 1902, the sway of alcohol over mankind is unquestionably due to its power to stimulate the mystical faculties of human nature. Sobriety diminishes, discriminates, and says no. Drunkenness expands, unites, and says yes. It is, in fact, the great exciter of the yes function in man. The drunken consciousness is one bit of the mystic consciousness. But now it was time to say no. A coalition of women, doctors, and clergy began to preach the evils of the demon drink, and the temperance movement became unstoppable at the beginning of this century. Edward Baer, author of Prohibition, The Years That Changed America, takes up the story around the time of the First World War, 1914 to 1918.
There was a movement that in a way superseded the WCTU, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, called the Anti-Saloon League, which was probably the first modern lobbying movement in America, financed by the churches, but also by large industrialists like Henry Ford, Pierre Dupont of General Motors, Edison, Rockefeller, and they managed to turn the Anti-Saloon League into a very powerful, financially rich lobby. And this lobby behaved with utter ruthlessness. Wayne Wheeler, who's now completely forgotten, but was probably the most important behind-the-scenes political figure in America at the time, he consciously fostered an anti-German movement. And he attacked the brewers because he said the brewers were kind of fifth columnists in America, which was totally untrue. But by the time America had entered the war, there was already the feeling that prohibition was around the corner.
And it's interesting, there's a parallel that over in England, the licensing laws that restricted the drinking time under Lloyd George's government were also introduced in the First World War in order to keep working people in the munitions factories in order. So business and industry were keen on stopping drink for their
Absolutely. Drinks. Another sort of key element in all this is that the American Industrial Revolution, personified by the Ford technique of making cars, the assembly line, meant that for the first time, you couldn't afford to have a kind of drunken or hungover lumpen proletariat. You needed skilled, sober workers, which is why Henry Ford created a force of private policemen who would spy on his workers. And a worker who was caught buying wine or beer or whiskey in a shop outside his working hours was first warned, and if it happened again, he was fired.
So this is the beginning of mandatory drug testing in the workplace.
Absolutely.
Now, the Volstead Act was passed in 1920. Calvin Coolidge called this one of the greatest social experiments in the world, and it was. It lasted 13 years. Here was a major industrialized country that said, we will outlaw this plant product alcohol, we will make people better. But as you've already hinted, it all went completely wrong. How did it go wrong?
Well, it went wrong almost immediately, in the sense that I think on the night after the proclamation of the law, a train full of whiskey was hijacked. And this was a sign of things to come. When you consider that whiskey, a bottle of whiskey, for instance, smuggled in from Canada, could be sold at 20, 30, 40 times the original cost. This meant that people were making huge amounts of money. And with limited amounts of liquor coming in, because it wasn't easy, it wasn't completely trouble-free, this meant that the gangs were at each other's throats to commandeer, kidnap, hijack stocks of liquor. And most, for instance, of the shootings in Chicago involved rival gangs who were fighting over quantities of liquor that one gang brought in and another gang wanted. This is, for instance, the real reason for the St. Valentine's Day massacre. It was a banal commercial dispute. That's what it was.
Prohibition ended in 1933. It ended as a failure, didn't it?
It ended as a complete failure. Many of the prohibitionists became anti-prohibitionists because they realized that the moral standards in America had just plummeted and that corruption meant that authority was no longer respected. Even people like John D. Rockefeller, and Rockefeller, in fact, wrote a letter that was published in the New York Times, which was a kind of tearful confession that he'd been wrong, that the prohibition that he had worked for hadn't worked because it had brought in its wake more criminality, more corruption, and indeed disease and death, because a lot of the liquor that was being made locally was lethal, and tens of thousands of people died or were blinded because of this. And there was a great deal of self-interest among the people like the Rockefellers, because in November 1929, Wall Street crashed, fortunes were lost, the country itself went into a deep depression. When a country is in a deep depression, it's very difficult to raise taxes simply to keep the government, the administration going. So taxes went up. And suddenly, belatedly, all these moral prohibitionists realized that if only one could tax liquor, if only liquor became legal again, then they themselves would be paying less taxes.
Alcohol is taxed and licensed and is thriving. Now in Britain, the drug is being marketed to children and to young people as Alco-Pops, flavored with sugar and fruit juices. But we're meant to be in a global war on drugs. This is a term that irritates Dr. Ron Siegel.
It's not a war on drugs in any country, because I don't see wars on pharmaceutical medicines, which are far more lethal than heroin and cocaine wrapped up together. I don't see a war on alcohol, really, which is in the United States is killing 500 people a day. I don't see a really deliberate war on tobacco, which is killing in the United States 1,000 people a day. I don't see helicopter teams trying to eradicate tobacco plantations in Kentucky the way we send in helicopter teams into South America to eradicate coca, which in the 5,000 years that coca has been chewed, it has never killed one person. Not one death in the medical literature attributed to chewing of coca. Now, there are probably 5 to 6 deaths a day due to cocaine. That's of no small concern to those 5 or 6 people or their families. But from a public health point of view, that's a small number. compared to the larger numbers of alcohol and tobacco deaths. So we only have a war against some drugs, not others.
And Dr. Andrew Weil agrees.
All this while, we've been living with the drug which is the most dangerous of all, alcohol. Now, this is the drug which, any way you look at it, is the most toxic. It's the one that is chiefly associated with toxic behavior. It's got a very high association with suicide, with homicide, with violent crime of all sorts. It's the only one that causes irreversible medical harm. And as well, we've been living with tobacco, which in the form of cigarettes is the most addictive drug known. So it seems to me that there's some irony here, that while we periodically become upset about these drugs that other people use, in general, they come nowhere near the potential harm of the intoxicants that we freely promote and encourage the use of.